Buying or selling your home? Real Estate for Life can connect you with a pro-life real estate agent. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 65% to Catholic Answers. Learn more at realestateforlife.org. Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kelly, your host. Yesterday, it was the Blessed Trinity, and today we're going the opposite direction. We're going complete opposite direction. Try to think, what's the opposite direction of talking about the Blessed Trinity? Yep, we're going to talk about demons today. We got Jimmy Akin here with us, senior apologist at Catholic Answers, and I've got questions I want to ask him about demons, and then the second hour, I'll let you ask him whatever you'd like to ask him about demons. That number is 888-318-7884. Jim, in addition to being a senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, Jimmy is author of, a whole bunch of books. The Bible is a Catholic Book, The Fathers Know Best, Teaching with Authority, A Daily Defense. I got a stack of Jimmy Akin books right here next to me. Jimmy Akin, welcome. Thanks for doing this with us today.
My pleasure, Cy Kelly.
Is this a topic that you have covered on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World?
In various ways, yes, and have done a good bit on it and plan to do quite a bit more in the future.
I know you have done some very good stuff. I've enjoyed the stuff you've done on exorcisms, and it just seems an area that is ripe for both scholarship and chicanery.
Mm-hmm. Yep, both of those things.
Yeah.
How about that?
Yeah, because it's unseen and people. So I know that you take the approach of faith and reason, and you'll apply reason and revelation to these things. Let's get right into it. First of all, I do think many modern people would say, look, when you read the Bible and you read about exorcisms and demons and all of that, this is essentially metaphorical language. We're talking about kind of human evil or the troubles that people get themselves into. And the demon is a metaphor, not a real person, not a real personality. What do we make of that as Catholics?
Well, this is an idea that has kind of been around to different degrees in different periods of history. When it really became popular was in the 19th and 20th centuries, basically after the European Enlightenment. And it has manifested not only in Christian circles in Europe in general, but it's also manifested in Catholic circles, particularly, like I said, in the 19th and 20th centuries. You would want to say, from a faith perspective, well, what evidence do you have mm-hmm. for this claim? And people who favor this hypothesis might say, well, when we look at the symptoms that are displayed, for example, by some of the demoniacs in the Bible, they sound something like symptoms of other conditions. For example, when Jesus meets the Gadarene demoniac, Mark notes that, you know, he used to bash himself with stones and howl and things like that. And you could say, well, that sounds like a behavior that could be caused by a mental illness, you know, this self-harm and incoherent ramblings and stuff like that. You know, there are various psychological illnesses that can cause people to do things like that.
Right.
Then in several of the Gospels, after they have had the Transfiguration and they come down from the Mount of Transfiguration, Jesus and his core disciples encounter a man who has a son that is epileptic. And he says he's had this demon since childhood, and it causes him to fall into the fire or fall into the water, and he foams at the mouth and things like that, which are symptoms of epilepsy. And your disciples weren't able to drive the demon out, but what can you do about it? And Jesus then drives the demon out. And you could say, well, this is a physical set of symptoms here. This boy had epilepsy, and it just got interpreted as if it's a demon. And so that's the kind of basis that someone who favors this metaphorical view of demons would have. They point to these other auxiliary symptoms and say these were cases of misdiagnoses. But the problem is that the argument does not entail its own conclusion. Just because someone has symptoms that can be explained by other known conditions like mental illness or epilepsy or things like that, that doesn't mean that's the root cause. And so these same demoniacs displayed other symptoms. They would, for example, display, like the Gadarene demoniacs, displayed an alternate personality that, you know, talked to Jesus and said, what have you to do with us, Son of God? Have you come to torture us before the times? And because this was a common view that, you know, there had been a set time when the demons were going to be punished. And so this alternate personality is asking about that. Now, you could try to say, oh, but that's just another mental illness. That's dissociative identity disorder. Mm-hmm. But how did the demons know who he was? How did they know he's the Son of God? They're also displaying preternatural knowledge here.
Right.
And so there are things that go beyond the symptomatology that you could otherwise pick up. And then there's the fact that the exorcisms are effective in these cases. Now, you might be able to say, well, in the case of dissociative identity disorder, maybe Jesus had some therapeutic effect by performing an exorcism. But that ain't going to work on someone with epilepsy. Because epilepsy is a physical condition that is not subject to the same kind of treatment that psychological conditions are. And so even looking at this from a purely secular point of view, as I have been for the last couple of minutes, if you look at the whole symptomatology, instead of just cherry picking it to support your hypothesis, it turns out that the symptomology as a whole does not support the conclusion that these demons are misdiagnoses or they're just metaphors or something like that. Then there's the fact that the Holy Spirit, moving from the reason perspective to the faith perspective, there's then the fact that the Holy Spirit has been guiding the church for the last 2,000 years, and it has guided the church to understand these as real entities. Mm-hmm. And even in the world today, we have instances where people who are demonically possessed, for example, can do preternatural things that science is not capable of explaining and that can't be reduced simply to physical or mental illness. And so, in fact, that's one of the things that the church insists on before performing a major exorcism, is that competent people look at the case and eliminate the possibility that this is just a mental or physical illness. And so it's only when the evidence goes beyond some kind of mental or physical illness that an exorcism is even permitted. And then there's the fact that the church teaches, as indicated in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, that demons are real creatures, they are real intellects, and so forth. And so I would say, from a point of view of both reason and Catholic faith, we're not permitted to simply interpret demons as metaphors for evil or things like that.
So you've kind of come near to it, but then if someone says to you then, Jimmy, what is a demon, really? What is it? How do you answer that?
Well, it's going to depend on how you're defining it, whether you're defining it from a specifically Catholic point of view or from a broader point of view, because there is a sort of anthropological concept of a demon, because you go anywhere in the world and basically every culture and every religion has a category for an harmful spirit. And so, you know, there are harmful spirits in Judaism, there are harmful spirits in Christianity, there are harmful spirits in Islam, there are harmful spirits in Shinto, there are harmful spirits in Buddhism and Hinduism and so forth. So, and in native religions as well. So basically everywhere you go, everybody has a concept of a harmful spirit. And so speaking anthropologically, you could say, okay, well, that's what a demon is. It's just any harmful spirit. Now, in Christian circles, it has a more refined meaning than that. And this deals with the history of the term. In Hebrew, to start with Hebrew. The term for demon is shed. And the book of Deuteronomy, for example, says that the gods of the nations are shedim, they're demons. And you say, okay, well, what's that? Well, we know it's some kind of harmful spirit. We can tell that much from the word usage. But they're also associated with the gods of the nations are also associated with some high-ranking officials in God's heavenly court. As far back as Genesis 6, but in many other passages, like at the beginning of Job, we read about God's heavenly court containing these high-ranking figures known as sons of God. And today they would be classified as angels, high-ranking angels. So that would suggest these are good figures. And what Deuteronomy seems to be saying is that at a certain point in time, when God established the nations, he put them under the tutelage of the sons of God. But then later we see evidence that some of these angelic creatures that are ruling the nations have gone bad. We see that, for example, in the book of Daniel, where we read about conflicts that are going on between the prince of Persia and the prince of Greece, and between the prince of Persia and Michael and Gabriel, who are archangels that are on God's side. And so if it's true that God put the nations under the care of these high-ranking heavenly officials known as sons of God, but later they're having fights, including fights with angels who are known to be in God's service, that would suggest that a bunch of them have gone bad. And that would explain why Deuteronomy can also say, why the Old Testament can also say that the gods of the nations are demons. They started as angelic creatures, but then they went bad and became demons. And that's the basic understanding of what demons are today. In church history, a demon has been understood to be a bad angel. Now, there are a couple of items of historical note that should be borne in mind, because the term demon hadn't always been used that way. Originally, the term daimon is a Greek term, and it doesn't mean what Christians mean. A daimon was basically a spirit that was between one of the high Olympian gods and humans. And so Greeks had this kind of multi-layered concept, of the heavenly hierarchy. Some Greeks would talk about there being a supreme god, like a demiurgos, a craftsman that made the world. And then there were the lesser Olympian gods. And then there were the demons, daimons. And then there were humans. And daimons, I'll pronounce it that way to keep it straight. Daimons were creatures that humans could potentially have interactions with and maybe even gain control over. And that term got borrowed by early Jews and Christians, and used for this additional category. But there's also another category that we find in a good bit of Jewish literature down through the Second Temple period, which is when Jesus lived. The early Jewish sources we have interpret the Genesis 6 narrative, where the sons of God come down and marry the daughters of men, as the early sources all interpret that to mean angelic creatures came down and had relations with human women and gave birth to a group of people called the Nephilim. You'll sometimes hear people say Nephilim means fallen ones, but it doesn't. It's actually an Aramaic term that means giants. And these giants then had a war, and they died. And in the Second Temple period, the common understanding of what a demon is was a ghost, a harmful ghost of one of these Nephilim.
Oh.
So there's a different understanding at this point. And so if you bear in mind that in this period, the term daimon sometimes referred to this Greek concept, and sometimes it referred to this ghost concept, it indicates that in this very early period of Christian history, there's some additional flexibility in how the term demon might be applied, but eventually it settled out to mean any spiritual creature that's not a human, in other words, an angel, any spiritual creature that is not a human and is harmful.
All right. That's why we asked Jimmy these questions. You get those comprehensive answers, more on the demons to come, and then we'll get around to your questions about the demons. Jimmy Akin, our guest. It's Catholic Answers Live, right back after this.
Catch Catholic Answers Live anytime at Catholic.com.
Catholic Answers Live is sponsored in part by The Lamp Magazine. There's only one magazine for Catholics seeking intelligent, witty, and clear-eyed commentary in our world, The Lamp. Subscribe today to join thousands of readers around the globe and enjoy inspiring, balanced, and truthful perspectives on faith and culture. Get 40% off a one-year, six-issue subscription with the code CATHOLIC40 at thelampmagazine.com. That's CATHOLIC40 at thelampmagazine.com. The Lamp is a nonprofit magazine.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Hi, this is Deacon Dennis Lambert from the Diocese of Phoenix. When we listen to Catholic radio, we receive encouragement, strength, and most importantly, we receive the truth. Simply put, we need Catholic radio because we are and we become that which we surround ourselves with. So I encourage you to tune in, inspire up, and to wrap yourselves in the warm arms of faith, life, and love.
The world needs EWTN Catholic Radio, now more than ever.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest. Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World gets a new episode each Friday. Guess what that means today? What dropped this morning, Jimmy, on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World?
Well, today is the beginning of September, and so it's a Patrons Questions episode. And this is different than our usual Patrons Questions because this summer I had a trip to Italy, a pilgrimage that I led. And a couple of evenings during the pilgrimage, we let the pilgrims ask questions. So these were questions specifically from the pilgrims who were able to join us for the trip. And many of them had to do with things that they experienced on the trip, including a lot of questions about a particular church in Rome that we visited. This is a Capuchin church, and locally it's often called the Bone Church.
Oh.
And the reason for that is you go into it and there's a series of chambers that the walls of which are covered with artwork, and the rooms are just filled with artwork made from human bones. It's also sometimes called an ossuary, which just means a place of bones. And they used the bones of the monks who lived in this monastery from the 1500s to the late 1800s to make all of this artwork as a memento mori. Memento mori means reminder of death. And so it's very startling and arresting because you're walking along and here is a chandelier made out of human bones and things like that. And it's very dramatic, but that's the point. Is to remind you of the reality of death. And, you know, you're going to end up here, not literally, but you're going to end up in the realm of the dead, just like these people did. And so if you want to have a good afterlife, you want to live in a way that's going to ensure you a good afterlife. And so it's not just a set of works of art. It's an object lesson to teach the spiritual lesson of preparing for death. And needless to say, after walking through those chambers and seeing all this bone art, the pilgrims had a lot of questions about that. And in today's episode, we also show you pictures in the video version of the podcast of what all that looked like.
And your partner in mystery, Dom Bettinelli, was there.
Yep.
He'll be on this episode.
Yeah. He was there. He's the one who's reading the questions to me.
Check it out, mysterious.fm, or check out Jimmy Akin's YouTube channel, growing each week more popular. Already, Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, one of the most popular documentary podcasts around. Get it wherever you get your podcasts. All right, let's see if we can find some way. The topic this hour and next hour as well is demons. And we decided we wanted, and I'm really glad we did, given what we just learned in that first segment about demons. I don't like to let the show go too long without finding a way to make it about me. So I want to know what I want to know what they can do to me. So what do these persons, these personalities, actually have the power to do in our daily lives?
Well, it's kind of a general question. It doesn't have a single answer because demons are like humans in that they can do a bunch of stuff. You know, it's like if you said, well, what can other humans do in our daily lives?
Yeah.
Well, they can do a lot of things. It depends on what they choose to do. And demons can actually do more in our daily lives than other humans can because they're more powerful than humans. They're fallen angels, and so angels are more powerful than humans, so demons are also more powerful than humans. They could do bunches of stuff, including stuff that I'm sure humans would even have trouble imagining, maybe even stuff we can't imagine. But we can say, well, what do they commonly do? Mm-hmm. And that's an easier question to answer. And basically, they are spirits that have closed themselves to love, which means they've closed themselves to God, who is love, and they've closed themselves to the love of God's creatures, so they don't love us. And basically, to the extent that they interact with us, they want to cause us problems. And in particular, they want to lead us away from God and to close ourselves to God's love the way they have. So they're going to try to, for example, get us to worship them rather than to worship God. That's one of the things that the gods of the nations did. They wanted people to worship them. That's not so much a temptation today, not here in the West, because polytheism has fallen out of favor. So that's not a big temptation for most Westerners. But another temptation that can equally lead one away from God is going to the opposite extreme of not believing in any gods, mm-hmm. and being either a practical or an explicit atheist. And so they can try to tempt people down that path to lure them away from God. They can also try to tempt them into a variety of other sins, whether it's sins of the flesh or sins of the mind, you know, like pride and stuff like that, or hatred. But basically, they're going to try to tempt people into one or another kind of sin. Now, in saying that, and so at least some of the temptations that people face in their lives are likely caused by demonic influence. But there are a couple of notes I need to make about that. The first one is, just because you have a temptation doesn't mean that it's a demon causing it. Classically, Christian theology has divided sources of temptation into three kinds. They're summarized by the words the world, the flesh, and the devil. The world means the example given by others. So, like, if you see someone else indulging in a sin and you think, oh, well, that's not so bad, maybe I can do that too, that would be an example of the world or someone mm-hmm. else's example tempting you. The flesh is our own inbuilt desires. So it doesn't matter. It doesn't have to specifically be a sexual temptation. It could be something else. But it basically, we are born as a result of original sin. We're born with inbuilt desires that are disordered. And when we give in to one of those disordered desires, that's an example of temptation being acted upon that comes from the flesh. The third, the devil, is the catch-all category for demonic influence. So demons can have an influence in tempting people towards sin as part of their ordinary activity, but that's only one of three sources. And we know we have lots of interactions with the world and the example of others. We know we have lots of interactions with our own disordered desires. So if you just automatically assume, oh, I've got this temptation, it must be coming from the devil or one of his minions, you're giving the devil too much credit. he's not that powerful. He's not that big of an influence in our lives if you're excluding the role of the world and the flesh. And so that's the first note I would have about considering what they can do in our daily lives. The second note is, since there's no way to distinguish for sure which, if all demons are doing is low-level, ordinary temptation stuff, there's no real way to be certain of where that temptation is coming from. It could be the world or the flesh or the devil. And because there's no real way to discern for sure which one it's coming from, it's not worth worrying about. Instead, when you're facing a temptation, the thing to do is don't worry about where the temptation comes from. Don't get paranoid about this is a demon or something, but just trust God and ignore the temptation wherever it comes from, and, you know, pray and do what you need to avoid temptation. But don't get hung up about, is this being caused by a demon or am I under demonic attack? Because unless the demons are doing something extraordinary that becomes detectable, there's no way to figure that out, and it's thus not worth worrying about. It's just going to cause you needless worry and anxiety and wasting time and energy on a question that can't be answered. So just trust God and forget about it.
That is very helpful advice. You know what? Demons is one of the most interesting topics for some reason. We got movies about demons. We got all kinds of websites that get into this topic. But that's one of the nice things about having Jimmy here, to take what has been revealed to us as Christians, what can reason do with that revelation, and what can we actually know about the demons. So we'll continue with more of that right after this on Catholic Answers Live. We hope that one of the things that we communicate here at Catholic Answers Live is that our Catholic faith allows us to be fully serious about all the problems we encounter in the church and in the world. But it also lets us have light hearts and maybe even mix in a bit of fun. And that is exactly what our good friend Joe Heschmeyer does in his popular podcast, Shameless Popery. You should check it out at shamelessjoe.com. Joe's got a deep grasp of the faith, of morals, the teachings of the church, all that. But he's also got a witty conversational style. He entertains and he informs. But you will leave equipped to better answer the most common challenges, misconceptions, and questions about the Catholic faith. He's got insightful guests, he does on-air debates, and he takes a close look into all the things that you want to know about as a Catholic living today. You'll walk away knowledgeable and filled with joy. Look for Joe on his YouTube channel. Check him out at shamelessjoe.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, become a patron.
Throughout history, some Catholics have been among the worst kind of villains, right? Or were they? In Canceled, historian Steve Weidenkopf digs into the lives and controversies of some of these Catholics whose reputations have been blackened, often unfairly. He takes on the anti-Catholic versions of history and defends not only these figures, but the faith they represent. Order your copy of Canceled today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
When the resurrected Jesus appeared to disciples on the road to Emmaus, they didn't recognize him until the breaking of the bread. The same is true today. In the Holy Eucharist, we really meet Jesus. In The Eucharist is Really Jesus, author Joe Heschmeyer explains how knowing Jesus in the Eucharist is the key to understanding all of Christian faith. Order your copy of The Eucharist is Really Jesus today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore. Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. I'm not sure about mixing the groovy music with the demons. It's good. It's a little relief. It's a little relief from the demonic theme of... We're talking about demons with Jimmy Akin today on Catholic Answers Live. Shortly, about 25 minutes from now or so, we'll be taking your calls. So if you have questions about demons, look, Jimmy will talk to anybody. So if you're not a Christian, don't worry about it. We'd be happy to talk with you if you are a Christian, if you're a Catholic, whatever. You're welcome to call with your questions about demons. And I've got a few more, and then we'll open the lines up for you. 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. So a demon, you gave us the basic Christian idea that a demon is an angel that went bad.
Past its sell-by date.
But yeah, that's right. It's sour. It's a sour angel. So what's the power ratio like? Like, does a demon, are they basically just the equals of the angels, or how does that work?
Well, that would seem to be the case. You know, it could be different if, like, they lost power or gained power when they went bad, but we don't have anything in Revelation that tells us that happened. So the presumption, it's like a human. Humans don't, if you got a bad human versus a good human, it doesn't mean the bad human is weaker or stronger than the good human. So in the same way, if you got a bad angel, the assumption would be that it's just as powerful as it was before it went bad. It's just using its powers for evil now. Now, there are different kinds of angels, and the high-ranking ones are going to be more powerful than the little lower ones. It's kind of ironic when you look in the Old Testament, there are a number of different terms for heavenly creatures. They're not all called angels in the beginning. Kind of at the top, you have the sons of God. They're the ones who are like members of God's court, and they're clearly high ranking. And and either at that level or just below it is the enemy of God, the devil, Ha-Satan. Mm-hmm. Or Satan in Hebrew. And he functions, as we see in Job, as the heavenly court's prosecutor. So he's right up there. He's playing a key role in the heavenly court. He might not be a son of God, but he's really high up. Then there are there's God's army that shows up periodically, and it's got a commander who's obviously higher ranking. We meet the commander, for example, in the book of Joshua. There are also throne attendants that God has. In Isaiah, he sees the seraphim guarding God's throne, and he describes part of what they look like. They've got six wings and so forth. He doesn't focus on what their bodies are like, but actually we pretty much know what the bodies of the seraphim looked like. Now, they don't really have bodies because they're heavenly creatures. They don't have bodies. But the way they were depicted or imagined, conceptualized by ancient Hebrews, was with serpentine bodies or snake-like bodies with wings. This is a known motif in ancient Near Eastern art. These figures appear elsewhere. For example, they appear in Egyptian art, where their function is to guard sacred space against unauthorized people approaching it. And that seems to be part of what they're doing in Isaiah. They're around God's throne, and they're preventing unauthorized people from approaching God's throne. Also, part of how we know now, these figures, when we see them in Egyptian art, they're often called uraeuses. That's the name for this snake or winged snake figure. In Hebrew, they're not called uraeuses. They're called seraphim, an individual being a seraph. And that's also the word for a serpent. So even if you don't speak Hebrew, it's not obvious, but the word seraphs or seraphim tells you this is a snake-like creature. And you might wonder, what are snake-like creatures doing around God? I mean, in the Christian imagination, snakes are typically bad, but what they also are is frightening and dangerous. So, you know, God around his throne, if you think about it from an ancient perspective, he's not going to have little weak, sissified, you know, throne guardians. He's going to have big, terrifying throne guardians. You're not authorized. You're not getting in here. And so that can explain why God would have snake-like creatures, at least ones that humans imagine as snake-like creatures around his throne. Then Ezekiel sees the cherubim. And this is another kind of creature that we know from ancient Near Eastern artwork. These appear in Mesopotamian art, and they're often depicted or sometimes depicted as bulls with wings and human heads. And they're described sometimes in the Old Testament as creatures that God would ride, kind of like men ride a horse. It says that God in the Psalms rides on the cherubim. But that's not quite what the way Isaiah perceives them. He perceives them as having four different faces, the face of a man, the face of an ox, the face of a lion, and the face of an eagle. And he sees them as having four wings And they also are throne attendants. One of the things we find in ancient Near Eastern art is that kings often had what are called chariot thrones. It's like a throne, but it's got wheels on it. So it's a mobile throne. You could make it roll. And that's what is depicted in Ezekiel. He sees God sitting on a chariot throne. And so God's throne has these wheels, and it's being upheld by the cherubim. And that's something we also see in ancient Near Eastern art, is servants who are throne attendants holding up the king in his throne, which has wheels on it. So that's essentially what Ezekiel is seeing in his vision. It's not a UFO. It's God's okay. It's God's chariot throne and his throne attendants. Now, you'll notice I've mentioned all of these different kinds of heavenly creatures. I mentioned the sons of God. I mentioned the Satan. I mentioned the cherubim. I mentioned the seraphim. I haven't yet mentioned angels. Well, they're down at the bottom. I mentioned the army and its commander, but I haven't mentioned angels. They're down at the bottom. And what the word angel means, malakim in Hebrew, it means the same thing as it does as angelos does in Greek. It means messenger. And so the malakim, the angels, are the messengers. They're like at the bottom of the heavenly court, and they run and deliver messages for God. And so since we humans are even lower than they are, it's normally the messengers that we have contact with. And so what happened is, over the course of time, we started using the term messenger to refer not just to the little lower down angels that we most commonly have contact with, but to all of them. And so that's how the term angel, it broadened its scope from just being the lowest members of the heavenly court to being everything in the heavenly court. Because if normally when we're dealing with a member of the heavenly court, we're normally dealing with an angel, well, then you can just anything from the heavenly
it's
court.
It's like shorthand, angel. Kind of, yeah.
Yeah, but you'll notice these different levels, they all would be presumed to have different levels of power. And so if you have a member of one of these choirs of angels, as they're commonly called, who's gone bad, they would presumably have the same power that they did before. And that seems to be supported by the fact that we see them having what you could call fair fights or equal matches. If you look in Daniel, at one point Daniel says a prayer to God, and 3 weeks later the angel Gabriel shows up. And Gabriel says, hey, I would have been here early 3 weeks ago, I heard your prayer, but the prince of Persia resisted me. And and the thing that finally let me get through was Michael intervened. And right now, Michael, he's basically got the prince of Persia in a headlock, and he's holding the prince of Persia. He's got him in this holding action to let me get through the lines to give you the interpretation of this vision. And then when I'm done, I'm going to go back, and Michael and I are going to wail the tar out of the prince of Persia. So what this shows is that the prince of Persia had enough power to stymie Gabriel by himself. And Michael has enough power to stymie the prince of Persia by himself, but not enough to completely destroy him. And it's going to take the combined forces of Michael and Gabriel to cause the prince of Persia to fall. Mm-hmm. So that would suggest we're dealing with fairly equal levels of power between good angels and bad angels. And so I would say that demons and angels are equal in power, remembering the fact that they have different power levels within themselves. Some are weaker and some are stronger.
All right. That'll take us to the break. Let's do the break and we'll come right back and get more on the demons with Jimmy Akin. And then we'll take your calls. 888-31-TRUTH is the number.
This is Archbishop Paul Coakley, the Archdiocese of Oklahoma City, and you're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Who was the first Catholic in your family? Were they evangelized by a friend, a coworker, a stranger? Did you ever think that you could be that person that God uses to save a soul, and that soul could save their family, their grandchildren, and generations to come? At St. Paul Street Evangelization, a Catholic nonprofit, We train, equip, and mobilize Catholic disciples to do the urgent work of evangelization. Catholic Answers is supported in part by St. Paul Street Evangelization, streetevangelization.com.
This is Deacon Steve Greco. We need Catholic radio to fill our hearts with our Lord Jesus Christ through the power of the Holy Spirit, to learn. We need catechesis. We need to understand that we are not alone. We need guidance. We need hope. We need encouragement. We need the love that flows through the airways through Catholic radio.
The world needs EWTN Catholic Radio, now more than ever.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin, our guest. And for this Friday, we're talking about the demons and trying to get the real story about demons, because there is, there's just lots of all kinds of things that it'd be very hard to discern which are true and which are false if you just devoted yourself to finding out what's on the internet, for example, about demons. So we're asking Jimmy. And let me ask you this, Jimmy, about demons, mm-hmm. if you could tell me. I feel like I know what tempts me as a human being, and it's very often bodily. As a matter of fact, pizza is one of the primary things. I don't think pizza could tempt a demon. Mm-hmm. And so it's hard to conceptualize why a demon would go bad. Why would an angel go bad, thus becoming a demon?
Yeah, well, so the church does not have a teaching on this. There are certain opinions or proposals that get floated, but the church has not signed off on any of them. So it's also, if you think, well, hey, they're a lot smarter than us, you know, why would they go bad? Why would they commit sin? Because that's not going to lead to good consequences for them. But then you think about it, even Solomon, I mean, he was the wisest of Israel's kings, and he had significant sins. So simply being smart doesn't protect you from doing bad. And as it's sometimes been said, sin makes you stupid. It leads you to do stupid things. And that's definitely the case with the demons. But in terms of what specifically it was, there are different proposals. The earliest proposal that addresses the question of why at least some angelic creatures fell is the one we find in Genesis 6 and in a lot of later Jewish literature down through the period in which Jesus lived, which was some of them got tempted by women. And this is very clearly the reason why some of them fell in some Jewish literature. Now, I would say, because angels don't have bodies, that that I would think there's, to the extent this in any way reflects something that might have happened in history, there's got to be more to it than that. I would say they probably fell, and then they it manifested in some way that involved women. But this is, you know, just trying to be honest about what the ancient evidence would indicate before I try to interpret it in a modern light. From a Christian perspective, this is not the first time that that angelic entities have been bad. Earlier than that, we've got the snake in the Garden of Eden. And, you know, talking snakes are not literal creatures, and ancient people knew that as well as we do. And there is evidence from quite early on that it was understood, certainly by the Second Temple period, that the snake in Eden either was Satan or Satan was behind the serpent. Mm-hmm. And so that would indicate a prior fall. And that's how the question has typically been framed in a Christian context of why did not demons in general fall, but why did the devil fall and take these other demons with him? And there are different proposals here. One of them, probably one of the more general ones, says, well, it was pride on his part. That's based in part on a later passage in Isaiah, where it's either Isaiah or Ezekiel, I believe it's Isaiah, where you have a taunt song that is sung against the king of Babylon that talks like, oh, I'm going to be like the day star, which is Lucifer. That's what Lucifer is, the Latin name for the planet Venus, which was the morning star and the evening star. And you have the king of Babylon being really highfalutin. It's like, I am going to ascend to heaven. I am going to be like the morning star and the evening star. But then according to the taunt song, no, you're going to be cast down to the ground and you're going to be like food for worms. And some people have looked at this and read it and said, oh, it's talking about the devil, except it's not. It's talking about the actual king of Babylon, just like the text says. So I don't think you can really, even though pride is an element in this taunt song, the literal sense of this text does not apply it to the devil. It applies it to the king of Babylon. So I would say it's more speculative about the role pride played here, although I don't think it's a bad guess. There are also other suggestions that are more specific. One of them that I find rather interesting is found in the book of the life of Adam and Eve. This is a book from around the turn of the era. It's either a little bit before Christianity or a little bit after the beginning of Christianity. It's unclear whether the original version of the life of Adam and Eve was Jewish or Christian. But it's a really fascinating book. I did a two-parter on Mysterious World about it. And it basically tells the story of what happened with Adam and Eve after they got kicked out of the garden. And it's really kind of a moving story because, you know, if you grew up in paradise, you know, you were created in paradise and you lived in paradise and then you screwed up and now you're kicked out of paradise. Psychella, what would the first thing you do be? You just caught doing something really horrible. Your first instinct would be to
apologize, maybe.
Yeah, and so that's exactly what Adam and Eve do. They try to apologize to God. Maybe He'll let us back in.
Yeah.
And then it's worse on Eve because she was the one who was more consciously tempted. She feels absolutely horrible. And then when it's clear they're not getting back into the garden. Now they got to figure out, how are we going to survive? How are we going to eat? They've never hunted before. They've never done anything like that. And so it's a very moving story. But as part of it, we get flashbacks to the role of the serpent and what his perspective was on all this. And so they end up talking about how the serpent fell. And in the life of Adam and Eve, what it says is, okay, in the beginning, you know, after God made the earth, he made Adam, who as the image of God. And so what do you do in the ancient world, Psychelet, with the image of a god?
You worship it?
You worship it, right. And so that's what the angels were supposed to do with man. And so you've got Michael, the archangel, saying, everyone do obeisance to man. Honor man as the image of God. And the devil, the serpent, is thinking, hey, I was here before him. I don't owe him any honor. He's after me. And that's what caused the devil to fall. It was the demand to honor man as the image of God. And so that's the theory articulated in the life of Adam and Eve. But there are other theories too. Some will say, well, God revealed that Jesus was going to be born as a human, and the devil couldn't stomach that. It was like, humans are these puny little fleshy wormy creatures, and how could the Son of God possibly become incarnate as one of them, and how could I possibly honor him as the Son of God if he's become this little fleshy wormy creature? And that's what caused the devil to sin. But because Revelation does not give us the answer, I'm comfortable just saying sin makes you stupid, and beyond that, it's speculation. Yeah. We don't really know. There are some interesting speculations, but I wouldn't bet the farm on any of them.
Well, I'll turn it back to myself then. We're talking demons with Jimmy Akin, and now that we've learned about these demons, I would like an answer to this. How do I avoid them and stay out of their evil clutches?
Okay, well, one of the few things we know with good confidence about demons is they don't like holiness. This is, in fact, one of the diagnostic criteria. If you read the 1614 Rite of Exorcism and the 1998 Rite of Exorcism, one of the characteristics is it's not sufficient because, you know, bad humans also don't like holiness. But if demons display a notable aversion to holiness, like they don't want to look at a picture, they don't want to say the name Jesus, they don't want to look at a picture of the Virgin Mary, they don't want holy water or holy oil touching them, you know, all of those things will set demons off. They really don't like it. And so if you know that demons don't like holiness, stay holy. You know, make sure you're in a state of grace. Say prayers. Go to church regularly. Take communion. Wear religious artifacts that are holy, that have been blessed even. So basically, just maintain a life of holiness and don't worry about it beyond that. We shouldn't get paranoid about demons being under every rock, because they're not. And they would, in fact, love us to worry about them being under every rock, because that wastes our time and makes us fearful. But just live a life of holiness and don't worry about it beyond that. Now, that's not a guarantee that demons are never going to try to mess with you. I view demons as kind of like bears. They're opportunistic predators. If you're out in a wood, if you're out in the woods, you don't have to invite the bears. If they smell food on you, they'll come. On the other hand, no one has to sick a bear on you. It's just, if you run across one in the woods and you're in a vulnerable state, they may take advantage of that. Demons, it's the same way. So, just go about your life, but don't be in a vulnerable state. Maintain a life of holiness and, you know, be confident in God and trust in Him, and don't worry about it beyond that. And if something unfortunate happens with a demon, then there are additional steps that can be taken. But fundamentally, just be holy, love God, and enjoy life.
I do want to, before we go, ask, and I've only left you about 3 minutes on this one, but you hear these three words: demonic possession, oppression, and obsession. I have heard these words in reference to what the demons, different ways demons can bother us. Is there value to these words? Do they point to real things, and what are they?
Yeah, they're used to classify, and there's also another term, which is vexation. Okay. They're used to classify different extraordinary forms of demonic manifestation. So this is not the ordinary stuff, like I'm a little tempted to have too much pizza or whatever. These are very unusual, and consequently, they're not very common. But one of them is oppression, which is manifest demonic activity in which the demon is targeting things in a person's life, but not the person himself. Like maybe the demon is trying to ruin your finances or something. Then there's vexation, which is manifest demonic activity where the demon is attacking a person's body, like he's causing epilepsy or deafness. Then there's obsession, which is where there's manifest demonic activity where the demon is attacking the person's mind, like causing mental illness or extraordinary temptations. And then there's possession, which is manifest demonic activity, which at least at times results in the demon seizing control of the person and acting as an alternate personality.
All right. And on that last one, possession, that's one that they never make movies about vexation. I don't think, anyways.
It shows up occasionally in movies.
Oh, does it?
It's just usually not the main subject.
So, are there any cases of possession that you have looked at that you thought that's a quite convincing case?
There are some more than others, and I do plan on covering specific cases of possession in the future on Mysterious World. But part of the problem in this area is client-patient confidentiality.
Oh, yeah.
Just like it can harm a person's reputation if you disclose their medical history, it can harm a person's reputation if you disclose their spiritual possession history.
Yeah.
And so the church is very careful about what it discloses, and there's not a lot of data available, which makes it hard to investigate cases from a critical point of view.
Oh.
We tend to just have to rely, for the most part, on the analyses of the people who were there at the time.
I see.
But it's not as easy to do investigations from a distance. But that's not going to stop me from making the attempt.
I hadn't thought about that. There is a reputational thing. Like, you were possessed. Oh, and thank you for the job application. But we've chosen a different candidate. You could be like, well, it got better. I'll tell you what, we're going to continue to talk about demons. If you have questions about demons from any angle, whether you are Christian or not, you are welcome to call. Jimmy's happy to talk with you. 888-318-7884 is the number. Start dialing now if you've got questions about demons, because those lines tend to fill up when Jimmy is here. 888-318-7884. Right back with more Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.